You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So I'm Paul Williams. I've known Stuart for quite a long time, but haven't seen him for quite a long time. So this is a great pleasure to be here with you. I'm a filmmaker and record company person. I found out about Stuart's new book and thought, ooh, this would probably make a really good documentary. And so I got in touch, and here we are to talk about it. So we're doing a live kind of conversation about the book, and then maybe I'll decide to see if we could make a film about it. So off we go.
So apologies for doing my audition for the film world in front of you. But it was the best way for me to go with it.
Yeah. And so let's get going about this. So, Stuart, it's quite a subject to kind of get involved with, this film. So how did you decide that this was going to be your next book? And, yeah, what was your entrance into this?
Well, I didn't really decide what it was going to be my next book. I knew one of the editors at Pluto when I'd worked with him at a different publisher, and he asked me to meet him and some of the other editors because they were interested in some old books of mine, possibly republishing. And I just said, why don't you do a new book instead of an old book? And they said, well, what are you, thinking about doing? And I suggested a book about the City of London and finance. They looked really bored. And I said, I've also been doing a lot of exploration of connections between fascism and yoga, particularly in the earlier part of the 20th century. And they said, great, fascist yoga, that's your book. So I didn't have a lot of choice, but I got into the subject in a quite roundabout way. So I used to go to local Islington Council gym in South Islington and do my weightlifting and boxing as people do. And I had my parallel, or had my career as a writer, where I had to do presentations. And I used to do things like learn my books from memory because I didn't like people mumbling into a page when I saw them read. And then I shifted to ventriloquism, and I got the idea that I could stand on my head and recite from my fiction. So I tried the yoga class. It was after my boxing class. And the fact that I'd been in the boxing class didn't go down well with a lot of the students. I don't know why. The teacher, who was from Las Vegas, said, but it's great. He's got all his aggression out in boxing, so he's perfectly set up for yoga. And she asked me a few lessons down the line. I was fascinated by all the talk of chakras and meridians and stuff, which I didn't believe in myself, and wondered how much nonsense there was in yoga as a result. So I would start going to more and more classes. And I quite quickly learned to stand on my head because I wanted to use it professionally. So I'm going to just do a little demonstration to prove that I can do it.
Not allow him to get away with that.
I'm not allowed to do a performance without a headstand now. You all, to be famous, you have to be recognisable, and I'm recognisable upside down. this was the sort of thing that I'd do.
Okay, it might be a bit quieter because I'm further away from the mic.
Wow. Paul can... That's not bad, is it?
Yeah.
I couldn't do that.
This is also the crucial moment to get any photos to post on social media, so I have asked Paul to do one of me because, this is recognisable. And I'd get up and, recite... Yeah, take your time. I'd recite maybe, 10, 15 minutes. Sometimes I'd get on my head and do a lecture for 30 minutes. I don't do as long now. And I'm just going to do a very silly poem that I wrote when I was a teenager just to demonstrate, not really what I used to do upside down, but it'll do. So this is called Gravity. It's very short. Gravity is a useful thing. It makes the world go round. It keeps the stars up in the sky and us down on the ground. So, yeah, I could be in this position for quite some time, but I'm not going to be. World turned upside down.
Very good. Very good. Congratulations.
Yeah. The first lady who taught me, who'd grown up in Las Vegas, she asked me how I'd learned to do a headstand so quick. And I said, well, went home every day and practiced. And she said, well, why did you want to do a headstand so much? And when I explained, she said, well, that's not possible. You can't possibly read upside down standing on your head. I said, oh, sorry, it's too late. I've already done it in Paris and Berlin. I'm going to be doing it in London soon. So that was kind of one way in. And then in terms of the fascism, which is, there's different strands to yoga. So there's the occult strand, and in the UK, you can trace that very much through figures like Aleister Crowley, who's quite a famous early 20th century occultist, known as the wickedest man in the world by the press. But also in 2016, when I started reading up on the subject of yoga, so I've been reading for some time, because anything I do, I get interested in and then have to check out its history. So I'd come across the kind of academic discourse about the origins of yoga, of which the most famous, but certainly not the only book, is Yoga Body by Mark Singleton. And so this talks about, in the 1920s, Indian nationalists taking Western exercises and reconfiguring them and saying that the exercise they'd taken was actually an ancient Indian exercise, and it was done in an inferior way by the Westerners who were doing it, although they'd actually stolen the exercises. So there's a whole lot of academic discourse essentially arguing that yoga is a kind of, at base, modern postural practice. I mean, if you're talking about the meditation done in India some time before, it would be different, but I'm not, because yoga is a homonym. So yoga is at base, as practiced in gyms and Western yoga studios, and certainly as I encountered it, Western gymnastics adapted with some kind of Orientalist elements or Oriental elements. And then a while later in 2016, which is how I started looking at the fascist end of things to do with yoga, I came across a magazine article with a picture of a guy in a half lotus with a MAGA, Make America Great Hat, on his knee, a Celtic cross behind him, who was basically a far right-wing activist. And the writer expressed surprise that this person would be into yoga and into tarot and spirituality and all this other stuff. Having come across kind of fascist subcultures, which we'll maybe get into a little bit later, I wasn't so surprised. And I thought, well, where there's one fascist, there's bound to be more. So I started looking, doing some searches for fascist yoga, and immediately came across some figures. So I'll let Paul ask another question, because it is my audition. I shouldn't hog everything.
No, so, I mean, and that's the thing, isn't it, that of course, finding, you know... So Stuart's a musicologist, I could kind of call that. I mean, any kind of genre of music you'll probably find within one of your novels or some such. But during the 70s in particular, we find kind of right-wing discourse kind of coming in through into mainstream culture. And so... when we look at kind of our contemporary culture, especially within the internet, we find right-wing stuff more and more kind of prevalent within everyday situations. So for example, with people like Jordan Peterson and all of that, I mean, the connections, you know, Alex Jones and all of those people, where do we find kind of connections with them and yoga? And
well, there's two kind of paths to answering this. So one is to go back into what might be the origins of yoga, although things get very murky when you go back. So having looked at this academic discourse suggesting Indian nationalists had taken Western gymnastics and created yoga, when I was looking around, I also came across another figure called Pierre Bernard, or the Great Om, as he was called by the press, because there was a sex trafficking case against him, which came up in New York in 1910. And he, from when, it's not clear exactly when he started teaching what looks like modern postural practice or modern yoga, but this would have been at least 10 years before the Indian nationalists, and possibly 20. And he was running an international tantric order that only existed in the USA, so not quite as international as its title suggested. So when you go back to him, you find an early example of this practice earlier than on the Indian continent or subcontinent. And, you know, the question arises, was there a transmission between him and the people in India? Did they know about him, or is this just people using what's around and creating something similar? We're not clear. But in the overdeveloped world, which we live in, it was Bernard's disciples who played a really key role in spreading modern postural practice. He didn't write a huge amount, although he did edit an international tantric journal, number 5. There was only one number, but he numbered it 5 to make it look like it was a bigger thing than it was. Typical con man trick. But one of his disciples, called Hamish McLaren, wrote a book called Eastern Philosophy for Western Minds, which he endorsed, and there was an introduction by Francis Yates Brown, who is a notorious British fascist. And McLaren's argument was that yoga was invented by the Aryan invaders of the Indus Valley. That's a valley that now divides India and Pakistan. So they invented it 5,000 years ago, and they also created the caste system to preserve the kind of pure Aryan blood. I mean, the term Aryan originally existed to describe linguistic and cultural phenomena, not race, and racial theory doesn't really make sense, but this is the theories they were using. So, I mean, the other side of McLaren was that he was very anti-Semitic. These things also apply to Yates Brown, who wrote the introduction, then wrote a book on yoga. So McLaren was very against Christianity because he saw it as Semitic and the wrong religion and moral code for Aryans. So he was advocating yoga as a true Aryan tradition and moral code. So anyway, trying to shift forward quickly and get to Jordan Peterson and Alex Jones eventually. The key figures among Bernard's disciples for spreading yoga in the first part of the 20th century were Francis Yates Brown, not so much through his 1937 book Yoga Explained, as the fact there were a lot of magazine features about him. So being in the newspapers and magazines really got the word out about their practice. Bernard had a nephew called Theus Bernard. Yates Brown faked where he learned his yoga, so there's historians like Kate Imey who've done papers going through his archives showing that he didn't learn yoga in India as he claimed, but in Nike, New York, from Pierre Bernard. Bernard also had a nephew, Theos Bernard, who tried to make it look like he'd learned yoga from an Indian, but he'd actually appears to have probably learnt it from his father and then from Bernard in Nike, New York. He made a lot of claims about things he did in Tibet, a lot of which his autobiography has now been debunked by academics. But again, he had a lot of newspaper coverage. And then there's a third figure, Paul Jukes, who some people might know because he famously spied for the British against the Bolsheviks in the early part of the 20th century in Russia, and is quite well known as a musician as well. He learned yoga from Bernard in Nyack in the 1920s, and he's quite open about where he learned it. So what are thought to be the first series of yoga programs on TV on the BBC in the late 1940s, they featured Paul Jukes as another Bernard disciple. So as well as kind of linking yoga explicitly to Aryanism in the Bernard Circle, the Bernard Circle were very important in spreading the idea of yoga in the overdeveloped world. So that kind of laid a foundation of things that after the defeat of the Axis powers, obviously kind of linking yoga to those kind of things wasn't going to be as popular, although you do find authors, popular yoga authors, and also authors on the occult, in the case of Harvey Day and wellness, in the 1950s, still repeating the kind of Aryan myths and still drawing on the kind of earlier, particularly Yates Brown, fascist figures within yoga, and even some more problematic figures like J. Max Riviera, who was condemned in absentia for his wartime activities but escaped to Francoist Spain. So he was a right-wing French figure who also wrote on kind of yoga and Tibetan things. So you still see that kind of being churned in a kind of underground at the same time as a figure like Harvey Day, who will draw on this stuff and talk about the Aryan origins of yoga in ancient India. But also Day is clearly very proud to have been part of the British Army that defeated the Axis powers and is also explicitly anti-racist in passages in his books. So it becomes a more complicated thing. What I noticed going to yoga classes myself, because I stopped before the pandemic, there was a lot of anti-vax talk within the yoga classes, as well as a lot of kind of occult material and wellness things that I didn't believe. You'd be told that, you know, for example, you know, standing on my head is good for apparently getting rid of a cold, getting rid of a headache, whatever else. I don't get headaches, so I wouldn't know whether it would get rid of a headache. But it seems unlikely for me. And you will find in yoga manuals even more extraordinary claims. For example, a shoulder stand will cure leprosy. You can cure leprosy. There are medical procedures if it's caught early. And injections people can have, but a shoulder stand won't cure leprosy. So when I was going, I would hear this kind of stuff in yoga classes, and also a lot of anti-MMR, mumps, measles, rubella, anti-vax things, which I found quite disturbing, and we're now seeing the outcome of that in terms of measles outbreaks and kids dying, which is really sad. And then obviously once the pandemic hit and we had the lockdowns and stuff, you saw a lot of kind of yoga mums standing next to kind of EDL types and notorious fascists protesting against lockdowns and anti-masking and protesting against vaccination, which, you know, science isn't perfect, but it's the best thing we've got to protect our health. So that's when it arose again, and also particularly a number of yoga influencers, particularly American ones, taking up QAnon theory, which has some very interesting parallels to esoteric Hitlerism, if people are familiar with that. There's a couple of figures covered in the book who are esoteric Hitlerists, Savitri Devi and Miguel Serrano, a Chilean, and Devi was a mixed British-French Greek parentage. She went to India before the war, conveyed messages to the Japanese for the Axis powers. Obviously, certain of the Indian nationalist circles were against the British, who were occupying colonial power. And after the war, the defeat of the Axis, she wanted to refound National Socialism as a religion. So she decided that Hitler was he who returned whenever he was needed, the late-born child of light. And in fact, had previously been Akhmatum and Genghis Khan, and as Hitler had returned as the 10th incarnation of Vishnu or Kalki. So Hitler is essentially a supernatural being come to save the Aryan race in Davy's configuration of National Socialism as a religion. And if you compare that to QAnon, where Donald Trump is configured as a supernatural being who's come to save the world from a cabal of paedophile cannibals, there are remarkable similarities. Again, we don't know who made the original Q drops, so we don't know if there's a direct line of transmission that they were familiar with esoteric Hitlerism, or whether they were just using the same kind of far-right mythic structures and came up with a similar idea without actually knowing about esoteric Hitlerism. But I don't think it's entirely accidental, those kind of parallels between the two things. I mean, if we were going to go on to Alex Jones, which I'll try and do quickly, I'm very aware this is my audition, I've got to let Paul in a second. If you go on to Alex Jones, I mean, one of InfoWars is horrendous, and all this nonsense about crisis actors and school shootings not being real, Sandy Hook. I mean, that's absolutely horrendous for the parents of the victims, etc. But where Jones makes a lot of his money is from his overpriced and rather poor, because they have been analysed in the lab by Vice magazine, for example, sent off his supplements to be analysed. That's where he makes a lot of his money. And if you want to go back, and having been born in southwest London and having not a million miles from New Malden, a little further into London than that, having spent a lot of happy childhood hours in New Malden, I was amazed doing the research for the book that a guy called Desmond Dunn, as a yogi, was selling a mail order yoga course from his business addresses in New Malden, born and brought up in New Malden as well, southwest, near Surbiton, near Kingston, if you know that part of London. He started as the editor of Prediction magazine, which was a big circulation occult magazine, and then he was selling occult mail order courses and yoga mail order courses, but he also took over things like he was publishing British comics and doing the British franchise version of American magazines like Fate magazine, with a lot of stories about UFOs in the 50s, and at the same time running a thing called Healthcraft. So he was selling a lot of supplements. So you can see this kind of fake news with UFOs, which isn't as horrendous in its social impacts, obviously, as claiming that Sandy Hook was fake. But again, making a lot of his money from supplements and using fake news to kind of push the supplements. So that's, you know, kind of trying to bring the different things together at different strands of things.
Well, and that's the thing, isn't it? That there has to be money involved for a grifter to, you know, feel like it's worth putting the time into. But what within the book, what you do is you know, you start with Pierre Barnard back in the late 19th century, and he basically then kind of started his. The reason for kind of choosing yoga was to kind of get the money off of kind of rich East Coast women in the kind of country club sect, right?
That was a bit. There's a two parts to this, but you're essentially correct. Remember, it's my audition. Never contradict your interviewer. But he started off. He appears to have possibly been doing medicine shows or something else. So he's selling cures. You know, snake oil salesman essentially. And then he moves more into the kind of sex magic, tantric sex. And when you read earlier academics about him, like Hugh Urban, who goes into, in his essay on Berner, goes into quite a lot of detail about the one issue of Berner's Tantric Journal, describes it as a typical fin de siècle mix of kind of Western interpretations of Tantra and kind of sex magic and other things, because Bernard was very interested in sex magic.
Was there a relationship with him and Aleister Crowley and people like that at the time? Or
I think you'd have found they were drawing on the same sources, so Helena Blavatsky, Theosophy, that kind of stuff, which you see running through different yoga figures as well. Indriya Devi, again, not her original name, a European. The reason why the female yogis in the book take on the name Devi, as I understand it, means goddess in one of the Indian languages, possibly Sanskrit. Where were we? So we're talking about, yeah, so initially he seems to be selling medical cures and things, and then he shifts more into the kind of sex magic and then into the kind of what becomes modern postural practice. And because he's written up as this horrendous kind of sex guru, and one of the things he allegedly did with the two teenage girls who were supposed to be kidnapped by him, was he told one of them that to cure her weak heart he had to have sex with her, presumably a sex magic, but this is in the newspaper reports. So rebellious heiresses thought, oh, this guy's getting a lot of press and will probably wind up our parents, kind of went to get instruction from him, and he drew in kind of people around the Vanderbilt circles and all sorts of other things. So he then shifted from just doing the yoga, although he still taught it, to running sports stadiums and being president of a bank and all that kind of stuff. So he was a really successful grifter, but he only kind of really moved up from the more low-grade stuff once he'd pulled in all these heiresses and also created convenient marriages for some of his followers. So Sir Paul Dukes, who had what's thought to be the first series of yoga programs on TV, married one of them, and Theos Berner married another, which was what gave him the money to travel to India and do the kind of study which he was then able to kind of create this fake biography around.
Right. And he also then made the famous film The Bengal Lancer.
This Francis Yates Brown was a different follower, and he wrote his supposed autobiography, Bengal Lancer, which was published in the US as Lives of the Bengal Lancer, and then made into a film starring Gary Cooper. So, again, historians like Kate Imey have shown how, as I mentioned, how Yates Brown portrays his learning yoga when he was a soldier in the British Army. He's not the only one to do that. JFC Fuller, who was a top member of the British Union of Fascists, and also came up with the early idea of militarized warfare that the Nazis turned into their blitzkrieg tactic. He claimed to have learned his yoga as a soldier in India, but again, Imey has been through the archives and shows that it was actually through from Aleister Crowley that Fuller learned his yoga. So they have fake autobiographies, but the Gary Cooper film bears about as much resemblance to Yates Brown's book as Yates Brown's book does to his actual life. But both Yates Brown and Fuller were invited to events by Hitler and the other kind of fascist leaders in Europe. And according to Yates Brown's biographer, his cousin Evelyn Wench, in a biography published just after Yates Brown's death, Hitler told Yates Brown that Lives of the Bengal Lancer was his favourite film, and it was mandatory viewing for members of the SS. I haven't gone through all the archives to check that because I don't speak German, unfortunately, but someone can who has more linguistic skills than I do.
And so, I mean, we were talking on the way over about there was the early kind of, your earliest kind of act, knowledge of yoga came through that TV show that was on in the 70s.
Richard Hittleman, Yoga for Health. I don't know if it was broadcast nationwide in the UK, but I was growing up watching London Weekend and Thames TV, and it was certainly, Richard Hittleman was an American guy who had initially yoga TV series in the States, but then had one in, certainly for London. I don't know if it was UK-wide or not. I never really associated yoga with India when I was young, because it was this American guy who seemed like a salesman on TV with dancers in leotards demonstrating these poses. And when you looked at books, they mainly seemed to be written by people with European names. If you went in a bookshop and looked at yoga books, which I wasn't in particular, but you couldn't help seeing them. I was going in and looking more for books on martial arts, to be honest. That was my earliest exposure, and it hadn't kind of pushed me in the direction of thinking of yoga as something particularly Indian. But I think coming up through the 60s when I was a kid, and the 70s, you had more of the kind of gurus being brought into things. And then this is one of the reasons I only go up to the 70s with the book, because you have more of these Indian lineages coming in. You have people like Iyengar coming over to teach people. So I did have a yoga lesson at my local gym with a woman who's allegedly studied under Iyengar. I didn't actually research it to find out if it was true. It didn't seem worth it. And I certainly had a very unpleasant experience of going to her yoga class. I only went to one. She asked me if I could do a headstand. I said yes. She said, do one. And I did it in the middle of the floor, and she was screaming at me, saying, no, you're supposed to do it against the wall. Well, you know, I didn't know, because I hadn't been to an Iyengar class before. I think people a bit younger than me, rather show my age, you know, do very much associate yoga with India. But I think if you'd been born in the early 60s like me, you wouldn't necessarily make that association.
And so what do we think then about connecting this kind of this history that you've researched so carefully into when we interact with a high street kind of yoga class? I mean, does it necessarily mean that the yoga teacher has got nefarious kind of belief systems going on, or how do we separate this?
No, I think the thing is that if you look at the average yoga teacher, they probably believe what they're saying, and they obviously have a hard time making a living. It's not easy. There's a complete inundation of yoga teachers in the world, and they can't all, you know, make a living. And one of the ways some of them get around it is by, you know, I'd certainly get it. I'd be told if I went to a yoga class, oh, you're really good, you should be a yoga teacher, you know. And I or my teacher can teach you to be a yoga teacher, but it costs a lot more money. So it becomes almost like a pyramid scheme, although those involved would deny this. But I also think there's a kind of parallel with when you look at people involved in conspiracy theory. So I think the people like Alex Jones, they really don't believe probably what they're saying. They don't really care whether it's true or not. It's whether it can make them money or give them power that interests them, whereas people lower down the chain actually believe what they're saying. So I think the yoga teachers that you'd encounter on the high street or in your local authority gym do believe what they say. And when they tell you that, you've got a detached retina, do a forward bend if you can, it will cure it. They believe it. It won't cure it. You'd be much better going to a doctor. But, you know, I don't think they're being cynical. But at the same time, you know, they're also replicating a lot of things that are quite problematic in all innocence and, you know, in genuinely wanting to make the world a better place. I think they're making it a worse place by kind of spreading a lot of wellness myths.
Okay, so questions from the audience, I think, would be really interesting to throw into the mix here. So do we have, if we, I think we have a roving mic that's going to come around, but if not, I can kind of run out with my mic and see what happens. But anybody got any questions that we can put to Stuart? This is always a kind of an interesting time for me when excellent. I was going to say, because there's never anybody that wants to ask a question, but there certainly is. Is the mic coming? Wonderful.
Thanks. I was forced to leave a class in 2021 because I wouldn't unmask and she wouldn't continue teaching if I remained. Who's Alex Jones?
Alex Jones runs InfoWars, so this is a notorious conspiracy site, which, you know, because of the damages the Sandy Hook victims' relatives have been awarded, was possibly going to, was it the Onion who were going to buy it? It had to be sold off to pay its expenses, but it ran all sorts of insane conspiracy theories and claims that, you know, when there are mass shootings, there aren't mass shootings. This is an anti kind of COVID lockdown vax stuff. It's just an extreme right wing conspiracy site. I sympathize with you over the masking. I actually was on a train going to Scotland just before the pandemic in March 2020. And I wore a mask, which seemed a sensible thing to do. No one else in the carriage was wearing a mask. And someone, or more than one person, took it upon themselves to call the police because I was wearing a mask to protect myself and also to protect other people, which I thought was the real reason for it, if I had COVID, from getting infected, and got grilled by British Transport Police as to why I was wearing a mask. This was about less than a week before the first lockdown. So it is really quite extraordinary. But by the time you're talking about it, the teacher ought to have known. And that is horrendous. I mean, in the book, in the introduction, I talk about a guy called Marco Mandrino, who's teachers, yoga teachers. And one of the things I was trying to highlight with talking about him was he does 200-hour courses, which is what a basic yoga teaching qualification is. You basically go to some place in Italy that he owns for slightly more than 2 weeks, and you make up your 200 hours of a yoga course. Other people do this by going to Thailand or going to India, but he happens to do it in Italy. And I don't think that's enough time to learn to teach something like yoga safely. I also think some of the exercises they aren't only found in yoga, but are contraindicative according to sports science. But Mandrino wrote a whole series of blogs in English and Italian to promote his business as a yoga teacher instructor, attacking the lockdown, praising figures like Gabriel D'Annunzio, a lot of right-wing cultural figures, and sort of said, described COVID as kind of terrorism. But he hadn't been terrorized because he'd ignored all the health rules that the Italian government had been brought in. So you will find that with quite a lot of yoga teachers. But, you know, to be fair, I have come across the odd yoga teacher who was very keen on masking and followed it very assiduously, and even on their social media profiles promoted masking. So there are both sides to it. I don't want to paint an all-black picture.
There's somebody right here and somebody at the back as well.
You mentioned Helena Blavatsky and Theosophy. What would you say are sort of the major influences on those sort of first sort of far-right fascists that invented yoga? And second of all, like, to what extent do you think, with the sort of anti-masking medical conspiracies, to what extent do you think, like, eugenics philosophy comes into this sort of ideological circle?
Okay, yeah. I mean, the evolution of the fascist strands in yoga and the kind of entanglement earlier on are quite complex. So you have a series of different positions, but what I think that you're seeing people drawing on things like the Arthur Avalon, the Serpent Power, Blavatsky and Theosophy, the whole idea of the practice originating in the East, the appeal of that is to do with the Mahatmas within that philosophy, and you see it going through the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which Crowley was a member of, not the Greek political party, an earlier British magical society. So you see that with the interest in kind of India and Tibet and the Himalayas, the Mahatmas or ascended masters, people reincarnating. And then, you know, I have come across this in yoga studios as well, in terms of a more modern version. You have the kind of starseed beliefs. So I've had people in yoga classes talk to me afterwards and tell me that they were starseeds and be rather surprised that I knew what this was. Essentially, they're a reincarnated soul, supposedly from a faraway galaxy, who've come to kind of lead humanity to a higher plane. And you can trace, again, you can trace that back through figures like the American fascist William Dudley Pelley and his Silver Shirts movement, and then back into theosophy in those 19th century occult currents. I mean, Blavatsky is just an absolutely key 19th century occult current. What you said about the eugenics is really interesting, because it's kind of, you do see that kind of attitude, depending on exactly what people's belief is, but you see it with fascists. And I was looking at the pictures of the horrendous anti-refugee hotel protest in Falkirk. There's actually one much closer to me, 5 minutes walk from my flat, but I didn't see exactly the same thing there. And obviously, one wants to support refugees and one understands why they're here. But anyway, that protest, there was a banner saying something like, kill them all, let God sort them out, which obviously, if you have a more Hindu take on religion, you might configure slightly differently. I think that's definitely there. It's not something I didn't really go back into eugenics when I was researching the book, and it is probably something I should look at. But there were all sorts of things that couldn't go into the book. I mean, it's a question of space. You know, one of the other areas of yoga that fascinated me in the 60s and 70s was people like J.M. Duchenne, who wrote Christian Yoga most famously, and other books like 10 Lessons on Yoga. And there are all sorts of other books like Yoga and the Jesus Prayer Tradition. So, you know, there's different ways in which yoga has been configured spiritually. And it's, you know, what I found interesting actually going and doing some of the talks I've done, for example, in Bristol, younger woman asked me about the fact that Christians saw yoga as kind of demonic and anti-Christian. And I think that's only, you know, that's a perspective she'd probably get from looking at recent media coverage, and I can understand she's not as old as I am, so she won't have seen media coverage going back to the extent that I have. Again, that's another kind of aspect of yoga that's interesting and that's been suppressed. It's kind of adoption to develop Christian spiritual values, which if you go back to kind of 19th century origins, one of the other elements that's important for the development of yoga is kind of new thought. And you see this particularly in an early figure in writing yoga books, Yoga Ramacharaki, or to use his actual name, William Walker Atkinson. And he did his books under an Indian guru name, his yoga books, but he also wrote a whole lot of new thought. And you can see that again feeding into through Norman Vincent Peale and all the power of positive thinking stuff. Peale was a preacher that Donald Trump encountered when he was younger and had a huge influence on Trump, probably the biggest influence. So there's all these of any religious figure on Trump. So there's all these, you know, bizarre currents floating around and going in different places. And, you know, that was a great point about eugenics. And I'm sorry that I haven't looked at that more closely, so I don't feel I've fully adequately answered it, but I've done my best.
There's questions back there, but just before they ask a question, so in another current relationship in politics is Modi in India, and didn't he just kind of announce a World Yoga Day? Or
World Yoga Day, it's been going for, I think, 10 years now. And that is was very much pushed by the BJP, Modi's political party, who are a right-wing Hindu Vista populist party. And what's quite interesting is if you look at and understand modern postural practice as something taking on board a lot of Western exercise, what Modi's done is shift the yoga to some extent from the original understanding on the Indian subcontinent. I mean, yoga isn't just Hindu. There's also Jain and Buddhist, and also via Tantra, influences from other earlier religions, less well-known ones. But what he's, because to create a kind of populist spectacle, you very much have the physical yoga, which in Hatha originally was just about a few meditation poses. And there are eight limbs of yoga, of which the physical aspect is very unimportant. But Modi's pushed it very much onto that physical culture level. And one of the curious things about International Yoga Day, it's on the 21st of June. So if you look at the Indian press, it's about how this is taking over the world, and everyone is doing yoga, and they'll have pictures of people in all sorts of places. And this June the 21st, I asked a few people I knew in London when I saw them, including one who'd just been to a yoga class, if they knew what day it was. And they said, yes, of course I do. Do you think I'm stupid? It's a solstice. then when I said it was International Yoga Day, I either go, oh, yeah, I've vaguely heard of that, or what's that? What's International Yoga Day? So, you know, obviously it's more for home consumption in terms of what Modi's doing. But I mean, there were some very, you know, I mean, when I do the headstand, it's a stunt. And obviously, if you're trying to get people to read your books, you need to do something to draw their attention to it. And that was one of the things I came up with. But you in the International Yoga Day, one of the BJP ministers, there was a lot of media reportage because he did 62 press-ups, which was, I'm not sure what his exact age was, but it would have been good for his age. Not spectacular if you're obsessed with how many press-ups you can do. I'm not personally. I do bench presses and I don't really bother with press-ups, but I'd hope I could get to 62 if I did a bit of training. But that seems to be me to be very much kind of doing what a lot of traditionalists do, which traditionalism is a reaction to the modern world and a product of the modern world, and ending up to want to be traditional, kind of actually completely subverting what would have been a traditional culture, which could have not possibly have had a concept of traditionalism. I don't have a problem with modernity. You know, we've been through it. It exists. We have to deal with the consequences. I don't think we can go back to the past. But if you kind of want to have this misty-eyed view of the past, it seems rather bizarre that you end up corrupting it with a whole lot of modern things and kind of completely transforming it from what it was originally, and which you're supposedly celebrating as a tradition going back millennia with you in your own culture.
Yeah, I was going to say greetings from Totnes, where I've moved to. We have quite a few people there selling this newspaper, The Light, which seems to epitomise wellness and fascism quite well. I wanted to get your thoughts on it, and also if you'd like to come down and give a talk there.
Yeah, I haven't been to Totnes for a very long time.
Great music festival down in Totnes every year, isn't there?
Oh, they've stopped it.
Yeah, blame The Light. what can you say about The Light? I mean, they have actual genuine fascists from, you know, what, Homeland or Patriotic Alternative and stuff like that, actually writing in the newspaper, spread the most insane views on everything from, you know, vaccine to 5G. There's no evidence that kind of 5G does you any harm, but they don't believe it. And yeah, it's I mean again this is something I've come across through people I've encountered in yoga classes, where they've you know, do you want a copy of The Light? No thanks, I'd rather not read it. And then one isn't surprised when they talk on how there's no longer any left or right, it's all moved beyond that, and we have to oppose the kind of authoritarian government that's forcing us to wear masks and vaccinate and whatever. Not when I was going to yoga class, they didn't say that, but I still see some of the people in my local area who I met at yoga classes, and they will come out with this kind of stuff. But yeah, it would be lovely to go to Totnes. I had a really nice time last time I went there, a really nice day, only a day trip. And yeah, the light is horrendous.
I'd never heard of it.
Thank you. I have been pondering upon kind of the fact that a lot of fascist movements arise out of anger or disenfranchisement, but yoga seems to be rooted in a kind of a self-focused wellness culture. And do you think that kind of entry point makes it almost easier for people to accidentally fall into it in a way that isn't common in other fascist movements?
Yeah, I think it is. And I also think the other thing is a gender issue, because, I mean, this is why you have the term pastel QAnon, for how all those wellness and yoga influences end up kind of getting into conspiracy theories and all sorts of other things. And also, you know, if you're actually trying to do an activist campaign on the ground, you'll find out that actually women can generally do a better job if you're trying to do things on a very local basis, because they will all know each other, they'll all talk to each other, and often you'll have men who they don't talk to that many of their neighbours. So once you have a few women convert through this kind of stuff, you've got a real problem with other things. But the other side of it is that when you want to save your local football pitch from the council building on it, you know, the same women as well are the best people to kind of do the campaign, because they just know everyone. And again, we're seeing that with the pink protests in relation to protesting about refugees in hostels. I mean, obviously, I understand the issue of women's safety, and that's important. But that's the problem with patriarchy. You can't just pin it on patriarchy more broadly. You can't pin it on refugees in being put it housed in hotels. And, you know, so yeah, but fundamentally it is more dangerous, because people think they're getting into something spiritual, not necessarily something political.
Very interesting. Any more questions?
Well, I've got a question. Have I passed the audition?
I'm still undecided, so we need some more kind of input for my application to the BBC to see if
he's a hard taskmaster.
This year's Christmas schedule will have fascist yoga as
He also told me that he was doing a six laughs test on me, so I had to have I had six laughs yet?
I think that was just six people laughing right then. There we go, we've passed. Now it's a comedy. Okay.
I was wondering if you see martial arts in some of this story as well. I think you mentioned it once, and it seems quite vulnerable to the same issues.
No, that's bang on the money, as I might say, as long as I pass the audition. So, yeah, I mean, you can see, one, a lot of kind of similar occult nonsense. I do actually practice various family styles of Tai Chi, but I'm very wary of the esoteric claims made for it. I enjoy the movement. And there are connections to the far right, very obviously, particularly it's obvious with certain Japanese martial arts. So Yoshiba, who founded Aikido, had a lot of far right connections, and you see a lot of that within Aikido. If people are familiar with Shorinji Kenpo, the founder of that was a Japanese spy in Manchuria in the 30s, and he allegedly went to the Shaolin Temple, deciphered the original, the murals and stuff, so discovered for himself what original Shaolin Kung Fu was, and went back to Japan with a lot of far-right connections. That martial art is completely connected into the far-right as well. And claims to be teaching original Shaolin Kung Fu as Shorinji Kenpo, having just looked at some murals and wandered around the old Shaolin Temple. And again, you know, the Chinese martial arts, you have that division within them between the harder external styles generally associated with Shaolin Temple, which is coming from a Buddhist perspective, and then the internal martial arts tend to be coming from the Tai Chi's and there's various other ones that aren't Tai Chi, but we won't go into them all, that are coming from a more Taoist perspective. And obviously, there was a reformulation, particularly of Yang Tai Chi in the 50s through Mao, which is where it became the 24 form, which became the kind of dominant world form. But now you see a lot of different styles coming up, like Chen from Chen Village, which is the original style. There's classes taught me near me. There's a big Wu family style center in Bethnal Green, which is derived from Yang, which was derived from Chen. There's various styles. But all the talk about energetics and kind of alternative health practices, again, that wellness stuff, I haven't seen it so clearly. I don't encounter so many problems when I go to a Tai Chi class as I did when I went to yoga classes. But the potential is certainly there. And I certainly, I haven't attended Shorinji Kenpo classes. I've thought about it because there are some near me. I have tried Aikido, and specifically Kyokido, which is also connected. Kyokido is a mixture through Toei, who was one of Yoshiba's disciples. Is a mixture of Japanese yoga, which is derived from allegedly by a Japanese guy from an Indian guru who no one can trace and doesn't appear to exist, which is a kind of recurring story with yoga mixed with Yoshiba's Aikido. And the potential for kind of right-wing ideology and those things is very clear. I mean, with some of the Tai Chi, I don't feel entirely comfortable with the teachers who want to make you salute the ancestors at the start and end of the class. But, you know, you can honour people and honour people's memories, sometimes the style just seems a little bit strong with that. You know, obviously, I guess they genuinely believe in Taoism and want to kind of take on board those ancestral beliefs, but I don't feel entirely happy with and comfortable with it.
We have time for one more question, I think. Ah, right at the back.
Hi, thank you for this. I was thinking about kind of the place of yoga in like capital T traditionalism. So, you know, like Evola and Gwenon, and then how their followers kind of go into Christian traditionalism. And I was wondering where you think yoga, like the part yoga plays in this kind of Christian traditionalism and the kind of grab bag approach to religion that it kind of exemplifies.
Oh, that's a very interesting and difficult question. Because I'm obviously familiar with Gwenon and Evola. Evola is covered in the book, and in some ways through Eliade and people, Gwenon is, although not as directly. Yeah, it's just a grab bag of beliefs. I don't spend a lot of time looking at the kind of traditionalist Christians that I particularly come across looking at the far right. Tend to be Catholic traditionalists, and there's some certainly very odd organisations connected to that. Society of Pope Pius X, I don't know if people have come across that, and the Society of Pope Pius X Resistance. So they're all against Vatican II and that kind of stuff, but they have different lines. So I think the resistance doesn't believe in talking to the papacy, but the non-resistance does. They would be very anti-yoga. I'm not aware of any traditionalist Catholic, not Catholic, Christian, because they don't have to be Catholic, traditionalist Christians who are pro-yoga. It tends to be a more liberal Christian who take that mix of material, but that may just be my ignorance. If you can fill me in on something, I'd really appreciate it.
Thank you. Those are some great questions. Just so we don't get barraged on the social media with running away before anybody could ask their question, is there one more that we can answer before we go? Oh yes, there's two indeed. Well, we might run over time.
I think my question is quick. Do you think there are any health benefits in yoga? And did you write the article in The Observer called "Why Fascists Like Yoga"?
The article in The Observer is a profile of me, so I was interviewed for it, but no, I didn't write it. So while I thought it was a great piece, I do have the odd difference with detail in it, to be picky. But no, I mean, I was overall really, the guy who wrote it was a really nice guy, and was very persistent, was constantly phoning me to get more detail and to clarify stuff.
You wait until we're making the documentary, how much?
Yeah, I'll get even more pissed off. It's like, well, I got to go and catch a train. anyway, sorry. So, yeah, what was the first part?
Are there any... Do you think there are health benefits?
Yeah. I think the thing is there are health benefits to any exercise system. So if you, you know, the greatest health benefits when you exercise are when you go from no exercise to low exercise. And then there are incremental benefits the more exercise you do, unless you start actually over-exercising, which one of my heroes, Bruce Lee, clearly did. But that it becomes detrimental when you over-exercise, but you have to be doing quite a lot to be over-exercising. One of the problems with, you know, a lot of the studies on yoga is there's no, you know, health benefits in yoga is there's no clear definition of what yoga is, even if you kind of refine it down to modern postural practice. So, for example, one of the guys I cover in the book, Frank Rudolph Young, a lot of his yoga exercises are what you would more commonly associate with late 19th century, early 20th century bodybuilding, and they're isometric exercises. So that's where you tense the muscle, but you don't move the joint, as opposed to isotonic, where you do move the joint in strength training. There are, I think, in yoga, you know, doing any exercise is going to make you healthier than doing none if you've got a essentially sedentary lifestyle. So, you know, if you go from sitting at a desk to doing a bit of exercise, that will help you. I think the back bending is potentially dangerous. I also don't like things like full neck rolls, but you'll find that in Tai Chi as well. I refuse to do them because sports science says it's contraindicative. I do think there are probably healthier things to do than yoga that don't include the back bending. It isn't the only exercise system that includes it, but there is a potential of damage to spinal discs. And when you go to a modern Pilates teacher, you won't get the woo-woo that you get with yoga. If you want a similar kind of sort set of exercises to yoga, you know, a modern Pilates teacher will be kind of focusing on the scapulars and the upper back, which from spending a lot of time looking at computer screens and driving a week, which isn't dealt with in the original 34 Pilates exercises. And also just because we have very different lifestyles from when Joseph Pilates came up with that system, it needs upgrading. I mean, doing exercises, exercise health benefit, modern postural practice is a form of exercise. I would say, you know, strength training, particularly the legs as you get older, because falls are a big cause of health problems in older adults. So you can do deadlifts and squats with heavy weights, for example, to do that is probably more effective. Also, Tai Chi is much more focused on the leg and a lot of weight shifting from leg to leg and a lot of balance. So it's probably going to be more helpful than yoga. But I wouldn't say there were no health benefits to yoga, but it obviously depends exactly what you're doing. It's very hard to quantify what the benefits are when it's very difficult. People have a whole range of things that they think is yoga.
I think we are now, we have 1 minute. So I guess that's 1 minute of rapturous applause.
Help me pass the audition.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.